Who's home? Hare Krishna.
Just had their second child 2 weeks ago.
Really? Where's the screaming little one?
She's sleeping.
Ah. Okay. 2 weeks old?
Yeah.
3 weeks.
3 weeks. And mom's helping. Well, you're pretty brave holding a program in your home after a 3-week-old child is born. Let's see if we're so fortunate. See how long the baby stays asleep. And fantastic performance yesterday evening. Fantastic. I didn't know that you were taking formal classes and dance. Quite a pleasant surprise. The topic for this evening, Uma doesn't know it yet, but now she will. The inspiration for the topic this evening came indirectly from her. Based on something that comes from Padma Purana, a section of Padma Purana, as many of the Puranas do, they speak something very wonderful about Srimad Bhagavatam. From my efforts in studying Tattva Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, I came to learn a lot of things I didn't know. That the extent to which the other Puranas glorify Bhagavad Purana. And for those of you that have been in academia, it would be something like this. Supposing you're an undergraduate student at a university and you have an important question and you've been given some opportunity to come before the department chairman of all the heads, all the departments at the university, they're all sitting at a table. And you come into the room and say, you're an undergraduate student, and say, I have an important question. Before I ask the question, could you let me know which one of you all I should address the question to without even saying what it is? And all the heads of the departments turn to one head of the department, of one department, and says, he is the most brilliant amongst us all. Whatever your question is, take it to him. Is that going to happen in academia? That's not the rule in academia. Within the Vedas, the whole vast body of the Vedas, there are different divisions. And in simple terms, there's the Karmakanda section, there's the Gyanakanda section, and there's what Prabhupada calls the Upasana Kanda section. Gyanakanda is the 90% plus, and it's describing rituals for elevation, gradual elevation from the lower modes to higher modes to mode of goodness. Karmakanda. The impetus is two, fulfillment of desire and act in a religious way so that when you fulfill that desire, you get elevation after this life to a better situation. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that's what most people think the purpose of the Vedas is. fulfillment of desire in this life in a virtuous way, and attaining the heavenly region after this life, and there's nothing more. So I'll just share with you. Hearing that from Bhagavad Gita, I've done some experimentation. And it's colorful. Once, without so too much detail, once was in Jaipur. I'd never been there before place, and it was at a university. A devotee named Pancharatna had started a center there, didn't have a temple yet, and details. I went for the first time to Jaipur, and he arranged for a program at the University of Jaipur. Lots of details. It was one of those really terribly boring institutional kind of buildings that was just like the walls are as thick as the room, and you know, real, just no windows, and just in a really long rectangular building, a room that was the place was packed. So I'll go through it. I've never seen these people, they've never seen me. So I just spontaneously asked a question. How many, I'm going to ask a question, and how many of you, wait till I finish asking the question, agree with the statement? And the statement is, the purpose of the Vedas is exactly what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, what many people think, or most people think. The purpose of the Vedas is to live your life according to theistic conduct, to be a good person, be regulated by the codes of the Vedas, so that in this life you'll gain piety, and that piety, the fruits of piety will be you'll prosper in this life, and after this life you'll go to Swargaloka, heaven. How many would agree that's what the Vedas, the purpose of the Vedas are? Everybody in the room raised their hand, almost everybody in the room. And then I asked the second question, is there anybody that has a different view of the purpose of the Vedas? And there was one girl in the back, because in India you got to sit in the back if you're a girl. So she raised her hand, So I called on her, and she had to speak loud because she was way in the back. And she said, the purpose of the Vedas is to come to the stage of pure devotional service, because it's only through pure devotional service we can know who is Krishna, who is the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and otherwise we won't know him. I said, okay. And I said, you must be reading Prabhupada's books. And she said, yes. I didn't say, and the rest of you haven't. But it was, if one hasn't, the default position is, that's what religion is for, and that's what scripture is for, is what we just mentioned. And that's what the Karma Kanda section of the Vedas is for. Persons that are, we were speaking yesterday, the unregulated bottom of the pyramid. And then there are persons that voluntarily become regulated by the codes of the Vedas. A phrase that's in the Bhagavatam several places, it's a metaphor. The comparison is made to a bull who is very powerful, but that very powerful bull is controlled by a little piece of metal that's in his nose. And a little pull on this side, a little pull on that side, he goes this way, he goes that way, because his nose is very sensitive. So they put a ring through his nose, put some rope on this side, and pull this side, pull that side, and he goes this way, that way, because he's controlled by the little ring in his nose, and he's sensitive to the feeling of his nose. Similarly, those who voluntarily submit themselves to the codes of the Vedas and follow Varnashram, those persons are dharmic. And that's the Karmakanda Dharma section of the Vedas. Follow rituals, perform sacrifices specific for fulfillment of specific desires with qualified brahmanas and so forth and so on. Accumulate piety, prosper in this life, and go to the good place after this place. in your next life. And millions of times greater opulence there. Now, for those people who consistently and successfully and over a sustained period of time follow the Karmakanda section, there's some benefit, spiritual benefit, besides the up, you know, the pious benefit. And that is, one, they're submitting to the Vedas. That means they're submitting to Narayana, because he's the source of the Vedas. They may not think I'm submitting to Narayana, but they're submitting to Narayana, you know, unknowingly or indirectly or whatever. Second, these rituals require qualified brahmanas. So they're associating with persons, qualified brahmanas are in the mode of goodness. So they're associating, through association, you get spiritual, you get benefit of those with whom you associate. And three, although the desire is material, material prosperity and elevation materially after this life, there's some appreciation of beyond the moment, that is, there's a life after this life. And so, with those three benefits and others, one may, as one rises through the modes of nature, come to the position of understanding, it's not just immediate gratification, not just intermediate gratification, not just long-term gratification, but then there's this soul. What am I doing for the benefit of the soul that's going to go to the next place? It may not happen. But if it does happen, that invites the person who is at the upper part of the pyramid, the Karma Kanda pyramid, to become interested in the soul. And that leads to the next section of the Vedas, Jnana Kanda section of the Vedas, which makes a distinction between spiritual and material and focuses on our real identity is in the spiritual side. Jnana, knowledge of spirit, knowledge of Brahman. And so there's a section of the Vedas that deals with Jnana Kanda, or knowledge of the eternal soul. Either of those two, Karmakanda, Jnanakanda, may, by good fortune, come in contact with someone who's carrying bhakti. And in fact, someone carrying bhakti could come in contact with somebody that's even on the unregulated by anything position. The carrier of bhakti can then transmit bhakti, or one may become the receiver of bhakti through that transmitter of bhakti, or one who's carrying bhakti. Through association of one who's carrying bhakti, that's how bhakti begins. Depending upon the space, is tomorrow's space going to permit having a projector and screen? Does anybody know where we're going tomorrow? Yeah? So I think tomorrow, a little warm-up for tomorrow, we'll discuss Madhurya Kandamani Chapter 1, and then 2 and 3. Or something. We'll see how far we go. Where what I'm just now describing, Chapter 1 of Madhurya Kandamani, is discussed by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. How does bhakti begin? The short answer begins by associating with one who's carrying bhakti. That's how it begins. It's there inside. It just needs to be awakened. It's awakened by contact with bhakti. Just like wood has stored fire inside. There's a harmonium. The case is made of wood. And it's just, it'll sit there and maybe even eventually just, you know, over however long it takes, rot, just become dust. But if one takes fire and touches fire to the wood that's stored in the fire can come out. Because inside the wood, the Vedic model is, there's earth elements, there's water elements, and there's fire elements inside the wood. Some air, too. Not much. So, and then combine them, you get stuff. But there's fire. So by contact with fire, the stored fire comes out, simply by contact with those carrying bhakti, the bhakti inside comes out. It's already there. So then comes this other section of the Vedas that deals with worship, and specifically worship of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because worship, at least devotional service, is meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Something else that I learned. Yeah. So, the Puranas are explanations of the Vedas. Just like if you read carefully, you'll note that there's parts of Srimad Bhagavatam that speak about people that are doing each one of those three. Some person's doing Karmakanda, some person's doing the Gyanakanda, some person's doing the Bhakti or the Upasanakanda section. The Puranas are explaining everything. It's a commentary by the author, Vyas, on the subject of the Vedas, explained in terms of history. So it's another section. It's a Smriti section of the Vedas. Amongst those, the Smriti, Jiva Goswami explains, amongst the Smriti section of the Vedas, there's different divisions. Technically, Itihasas and Puranas. Itihasas include things like Mahabharata and Ramayana. And Puranas include, there's 18 principal and so many other secondary Puranas. And there is some distinction about the type of Sanskrit, etc., etc., between the two, but rather than going there, Jiva Goswami explains, where I'm headed is, Jiva Goswami explains, amongst the Puranas, the Sanskrit is easier, they're available in fullness, many of them, compared to the Shruti section of the Vedas. The Shruti section of the Vedas means the Upanishads and the Rig Veda, Sama Veda, Yajur Veda, Tarva Veda. In short, there's about 13%, 12 to 13% still remaining of what was originally written by Vyas. So imagine, there's 700 verses of Bhagavad Gita. Imagine if you had 12 or 13% of the verses of Bhagavad Gita and you were asked to explain the meaning. Supposing it was chapter 1 and you're asked to explain the meaning. What's the message of Bhagavad Gita? It'd be, you know, good luck. So, without all the logic that he presents, actually the Puranas are better sources of knowledge of the Vedas than the Shruti section for those reasons. So now amongst the Puranas, what's best? And where he goes is, the mode of goodness, according to Bhagavad Gita, amongst the modes of nature is best. Ignorance, passion, goodness, goodness is best. And other references that say the same. So in that manner, the Puranas are divided according to the modes of nature, ignorance, passion, goodness. And there's a nice explanation of how do you get that. It's not like they're ignorant Puranas or passionate Puranas. Rather, it's written, there's different explanations, but it's written for people in those modes to help elevate them. In Gopi Pranadana Prabhu's explanation, there are days of Brahma, where the mode that he's influenced by is more prominent this way, that way, or the other way. Just like we might have a bad day or something. And the Puranas are issued for resembling and supportive of those. So there's six and six makes 18 principal Puranas for each of the modes of nature. So of the Puranas, those in the mode of goodness are best. And The Padma Purana is one of those, and Vishnu Purana, and Kurma Purana, Matsya Purana, Bhagavad Purana. There's Puranas in the mode of goodness. All of the Puranas speak of one of the Puranas, like that little example of walking into a room full of all the department heads at a university, and they all turn to one saying, he's the best. Whatever question you have, just ask him, because he's the brightest person in the room, the most knowledgeable, the final authority that we all accept person in the room. The Puranas speak of the Bhagavatam in that way, as the Amala Purana, the emperor amongst kings and so forth. It's the final authority, it's the Supreme Court amongst all of the other Puranas, including, you know, Tamasic and Rajasic, as well as Sattvic Puranas. So there's a section of Padma Purana, for those of you that are a little familiar. Our line of disciplic succession comes from Lord Brahma. And from Lord Brahma to Madhva, and Madhva to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and so ours is the Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya. Over here, there's the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, and that's the Sri Sampradaya. And for the Sri Sampradaya, their principal sources of reference, their authority, is not the Bhagavad Purana as it is for us, it's the Padma Purana, Vishnu Purana principle. They honor the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Purana, but their principal authority is those two. Interesting. Within the Padma Purana, there's a Bhagavat Mahatmya section. It's glorifying Bhagavad Purana, like the other Puranas do. And I'll get to what Uma asked a question in this morning class. That's the background behind it is something from Bhagavat Mahatmya from Padma Purana. So we're going to hear a little bit about that. Did you get the file? I sent you the file. Okay. Now, before we go to Padma Purana, let's go to Srimad Bhagavatam. There's a well-known verse, often quoted verse, that speaks of the power of the holy name, because within the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's emphasis on the chanting of the holy name. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu didn't just pull it out of the air, oh, I'm the yoga avatar and I'll just speak about the holy name. The scriptural authority is Srimad Bhagavatam, and it speaks about it many places. And one of those many places is the second canto. It's the initial instructions of Shukadev Goswami. Anybody here not know who is Shukadev Goswami? Am I losing people because I'm speaking something different? You know Shukadev Goswami, right? Yeah? Shukadev Goswami?
Yeah.
Okay. Shukadev Goswami is the speaker of the Bhagavatam, and the one who is receiving it is the most qualified receiver, Maharaj Parikshit. Maharaj Parikshit is the grandson of the Pandavas, or even more specifically, the grandson of Arjuna. Because Arjuna's son was Abhimanyu, and Abhimanyu's son was Maharaj Parikshit. So Maharaj Parikshit is receiving the message of Srimad Bhagavatam, and the situation is, after describing so much of the glories of Maharaj Parikshit, something very surprising happened. Very surprising. He lost it. He offended a brahmana. Maharaj Parikshit wouldn't do anything like that. He became overwhelmed by his thirst. He was off in the forest, and he was getting thirsty, and he became so thirsty he couldn't wait till he got back to the palace, and so he saw a hermitage of a sage, and he went to the hermitage of the sage to request some water. But the sage was meditating, and he was in trance. And Maharaj Pariksit, uncharacteristic behavior number two, he spoke harshly to the sage who was in meditation trance. Said, "What kind of a Brahmin are you? You can't even receive a guest? I'm the king." There's another thing. "I'm the king." That's not Maharaj Pariksit. He's not situated in the conception of his position in the world. "And you're not even offering me water? What kind of Brahmana are you?" And he left. Harumph. And when he went outside the hermitage of the sage, he saw a dead snake on the ground. So with the tip of his sword, he picked up the dead snake, went back in the hermitage, and put it around his neck, saying, "This is a suitable garland for you." Three strikes and you're out, right? At least in baseball. And he left back to the palace to get some water. And on the way back, he had this uh-oh feeling. Uh-oh. I made a big mistake. I've offended a Brahmana. And I know there's going to be a reaction for offending a Brahmana. And although he hadn't read Srimad Bhagavatam, he was following its teachings because it hadn't even been composed yet, he was prepared to accept whatever reaction was coming to him from the Lord. Whatever that is, let it come. And sure enough, it came. It came to him in the form of a message that from the sage, that when the son of the sage came back and saw the snake around his father's neck, he burst out in anger and found out this was the king that did this to my father. I curse the king. He's going to die in 7 days from the bite of a mystical snake bird. There's no such thing. There's birds and there's snakes and there's not a snake bird, but it's a mystical creature was created by this young Brahmin boy because he knew the mantra to do it. Then the father, Brahmana, sent a messenger to the king to say, "I feel really badly, but the curse of my son can't be taken back. You're going to die in 7 days." So the king got the word. This is the reaction for his offending the Brahmana. I accept it. He could have done something to try to counteract or whatever, whatever. He just accepted it. He gave his kingdom to his son, Janamejaya. And so Janamejaya became the next king. Maharaj Pariksit went to the bank of the Ganges, dressed not in his royal attire, but in a mendicant's cloth, invited the sages to come and advise him how to prepare over the next 7 days for his death. They all assembled. They were discussing, came to no conclusions. And then Shukadeva Goswami appeared. And then he asked, this is the end, the last chapter of Canto 1. He asked his question, or actually it was two questions. What is the duty of a man who is about to die? Not only me, but people in my kingdom, because today or tomorrow, we're all going to die. What's the duty of the one who's going to die? And second question is, what is that subject matter that one should hear, chant, and remember? Always. The first three chapters of Canto 2 are a collective answer, Shukadeva Goswami answering those two questions, And the verse I'm going to read from is from chapter 3. It's kind of like the wrap-up summary of the message of the first two. And it's the short is, it's devotional service, fixing the mind in devotional service upon the personality of Godhead through the medium of hearing about him and hearing his name and glories is what you should do, and that's what you should hear. So here's the verse, and you'll see the connection between this verse and the Padma Purana reference that comes next. Certainly that heart is steel-framed, which, in spite of one's chanting the holy name of the Lord, with concentration, does not change. When ecstasy takes place, tears fill the eyes, and the hairs stand on end. So those three symptoms, they're symptoms of bhava. So one whose heart doesn't change from the material position to the bhava position, that heart is steel-framed. And I was always wondering, how did it get steel-framed in Srimad Bhagavatam time? So the translation of this word, ashma saram, saram means like the essence or having the quality of ashma. Ashma is translated in different ways. Sometimes steel, more commonly stone, or sometimes iron, but commonly stone. Stone-hearted, steel-hearted, iron. It's like not soft. Hard. Hard-hearted. Ashma saram. Steel-framed. It's due to offenses, and in the purport Prabhupada describes offenses. And offenses have a consequence. The consequence of offense is something arises in the heart that makes the heart steel-framed or hard, not soft. Anarthas are the consequence of offense. It's one of the sources of unwanted things in the heart or anarthas in the heart that make the heart steel frame, so that even when the holy name enters the heart, the power of the holy name gets blocked. So one doesn't go quickly to the stage of ecstasy or hair stunned and tears come to the eyes and ecstasy takes place, the change of heart. So this phrase, change of heart, from this verse, chapter 3, is referred to again and again in subsequent verses, the change of heart. In fact, that's the title of the whole chapter. Devotional service, change of heart. But along with the chanting of the holy name, we have other activities in devotional service. Some of you have read Nectar of Devotion by Rupa Goswami, and Rupa Goswami identifies 64 items of devotional service. He says that 5 of them are most special and potent, in fact so potent that if any one of them even once is performed without offense, small condition, no offense means no anarthas, so then the stage of bhava is at once achieved. This steel-framed condition is at once surpassed. At once, but without offense. If we get this far tomorrow or to the next day in Madhurya Kandamani, the Vishwanath says the root of all offenses is inattentiveness. So how to be attentive? Striving to be attentive when chanting the holy name is the best thing to do. Of course, you can do it mechanically or you can eventually get it and do it devotionally, but inattentiveness is the root of offense. Attentiveness is the root of overcoming offense. So now we'll go over here to one of the places in the Puranas that say this Srimad Bhagavatam is the emperor. It's the final authority. We accept it. Everyone should accept it. It's the best. So Padma Purana says that about Bhagavat Purana. It's called Bhagavat Mahatmya section. And the little section is saying essentially the same thing this one verse is saying from the chapter 2, canto 3, Bhagavatam. Only there's a whole series of verses. The message is, and then I'm going to read a little section, and then we're done. The message is, we're all at some stage of devotional practice, beginning, intermediate, or wherever we are, hopefully progressing on the path of bhakti. And the very same activity that we're all doing is going to have a different effect on each one of us, depending upon how absorbed we are in the activity, how attentive we are within the activity, with our regard for the activity. Specific to this message is the hearing of the message of Srimad Bhagavatam. Little sharing on a personal side. I can't remember what it was, month and a half ago, I was visiting the Potomac Temple, and in the audience there was Anuttama, there was Rukmini, Prabhupada disciples, there's Ananda Vrindavan, there's Brajvihari, and there's over there was Haridas, another Prabhupada disciple, like very senior devotees, and you know, others who are also there. And a classic for Rukmini, she asked a very short but very pointed question during the question answer session. What is it that has kept you engaged in Krishna consciousness for all these years? You've been engaged for, you know, some number of years. What is it that keeps you going? It was relevant to the subject we were discussing, the verse and purport, and I hadn't thought of an answer, but it was really easy to give the answer. I said two things, gratitude and Srimad Bhagavatam. That they both give me life and keep me going. I have a lot of faith in Srimad Bhagavatam and its message from practical experience of seeing how it's transformed my life. I mean, it's not that other things haven't, but that's especially had an impact. So this reference has some special meaning for me. The qualitative way in which you hear Srimad Bhagavatam is going to determine how much benefit you get from it. But part of it is faith. Faith in the sound vibration itself, are we okay? But another part is faith of the broadcaster of that sound vibration, just like Shukadeva Goswami speaking, Maharaj Pariksit, you know, the broadcaster and the receiver, perfect transmission. So the historic or the Puranic presentation on this topic from Padma Purana is a little history of a brahmana and his wife and their adopted son and the wife's sister's son. So the names, the brahmana was named Atmadev, and his wife was named Dunduli. They had adopted a child, and the adopted child's son was called Gokarna. And Dunduli had a sister and Dundali was assisting her sister by raising her child, another Brahmana, and his name was Dundukari. But Dundukari was wicked. He was Brahmana by birth, but his behavior wasn't Brahmana. He was wicked. Very, very bad. And when, as a young man, he died untimely death and became a ghost. So his, I guess, stepbrother or something, Gokarna, was very compassionate. And so for the benefit of his departed stepbrother, who had become a ghost, he recited Srimad Bhagavatam in 7 days. And at the end of, and there was a big audience, or some audience, and at the end of that 7 days, the ghost Dundali manifested right there in the assembly of all the audience and the speaker, Gokarna. And he was manifesting in the language of the Padma Purana in a Vaikuntha form, darkish color, glowing blue dhoti, crown jewels, tulsi garland. So previously his form was not visible because he was a ghost, and all of a sudden he got this visible form that was like a celestial form. And Dundali, Dundukari, started praising his stepbrother, Gokarna, for how wonderfully he was reciting the Bhagavatam and how much he had benefited, and praising him and praising him and thanking him. And right then, in the midst of all that assembly, this celestial Vaikuntha Vimana descended. And the agents of Lord Vishnu, the Vishnu Dutas, agents of Hari, they invited Dundukari in this celestial form to get on the Vimana and come with us back to Vaikuntha. So the reciter of the Bhagavatam, Gokarna, asked the agents of Lord Vishnu, before you leave, could you help me understand something? There were so many people in the audience, and they were hearing the same message as Dundukari was hearing. But you're taking him back to Godhead and leaving the rest of us behind. Please explain why there's a different result for him and for us. And then the Vishnu Dutas, or the agents of Hari, gave the following answer. Listen carefully. The difference in results come from the differences in the quality of their hearing. Think of this Canto 2, Chapter 3 verse. Everyone present, it is true, listen to the Bhagavatam, but two things. Not everyone reflected on what they heard. The difference in results came from this, as well as, two, from the quality of their worship. So it explains this, although he was in a ghost form, and he was like spooking the village where everybody lived. I'm reading the translation. The ghost listened for 7 days, but each night he worshipped the Lord, during which time he reflected with concentration on what he had heard. No, the application part. Bring it inside in the language of the Bhagavatam, Shrinvanti, Gayanti, Grinanti. He reflected with concentration on what he heard. Knowledge which is unstable is lost. know you have to hear this phrase. If you don't use it, you lose it. As is the learning of someone who has been inattentive. Attentiveness is something you have to cultivate. Whatever your attentiveness capacity is, keep going. Cultivate it further and further. And something that helps attentiveness is application. Part of it is explaining what you've heard to others. You know, Tushan Ticha Raman Ticha, you get together and discuss. Just a little, one of the things that we used to do when hearing Srila Prabhupada's classes, when he was, certainly when he was giving them live, we go to the prasadam and we just talk, discuss the points that we heard. And, you know, somebody remembers something that we forgot, and somebody will understand something that we understood, but understood it in a slightly different way. And it strengthened our relationship with one another and our relationship with Prabhupada and our attentiveness to hear, not just so we could, you know, have a sparring match during prasadam who could remember more, but strengthen our relationship in the application of the teachings of our spiritual master. Or you may do this sometimes in your gatherings. You hear a class and speak what do you remember hearing, or just even read. This is one of the practices of groups getting together. Read a paragraph, and the facilitator has his pen ready or her pen ready to say, okay, what's the main point? And it's interesting how long it takes to get the main point and articulate it in a way that everybody can agree. But, you know, you can do that. Then as a group, you get to understand one another and certainly get to understand how to read Prabhupada's books, how to hear his message. What's the main point? And then you can say secondary points and then cultural points. But what's the main point? And then how do you apply it? How do you explain it? How do you apply it? Japa done without concentration or hearing advice which comes from a doubtful source are both wasted. Well, you know, we're very careful about not hearing, we should be, more consistently we're careful about hearing from an unreliable source, maybe less so in the matter of concentration. We all chant, but certainly there's lots of room for improvement in concentration, but what the Padma Purana is saying here is japa done without concentration, language here is wasted. A land without Vaishnavas is worthless, as is the offering of oblations by a person without qualifications. Or charity given to an unlearned person and a family which has no ethical principles. Just a little sidebar, and then this next sentence is the main message for this evening. A presentation that I've been giving at universities this semester so far, there's like four or five of them, on this one topic, how modern society promotes or encourages, nourishes narcissism. And I explained at the beginning, my interest in this topic came when someone forwarded to me a 30-minute interview of Gene Twenge, who is a professor at San Diego State, who has spent some 15, 18 years studying the topic. And a person from National Public Radio interviewed her. And it was eye-opening. And so that got me interested in the subject, and there's lots of research in the subject. And one of the characteristics of millennials, which is largely her the audience that she's studying, you know, as a university professor, it's university students and recent graduates from the universities. What's the culture of the millennials? What has impacted the culture to make it like it is? And what's the product of that culture? And one of the primary symptoms, well, Narcissus is a person from Greek mythology. That where the narcissism comes from is Greek mythology. And he was a hunter who was super beautiful. And he was like filled with himself about how beautiful he was. And he was so proud of his beauty that when people were attracted to his beauty, he found them disgusting. So that's one of the reasons he was off in the forest, because he didn't have to interact with anybody. And then one fine day, in Greek mythology, he saw a pond or lake, and in the pond or lake he saw his reflection. And he became so overwhelmed with attraction for his reflection that he couldn't move. In fact, he died of starvation, just looking at his reflection, falling in love with his reflection. That was the end of Narcissus. So, a narcissism is one who's so much absorbed in beyond, you know, appropriate level of fascination with one's how one appears to others. So it's not what's inside, but how you appear to others. You know, the masks and the pretenses and the and so forth and so on. And not symptomatic of this is not caring for social norms. Not accepting, like we were discussing, another one of Uma's questions yesterday, is that the distinction between family tradition or the culture of the world around you, you know, the norms here, it's proper conduct or ethical principles. Like, you know, forget ethical principles. It's, if it feels good, do it. And don't tell me anything else. Anyway. If you can get away with it, if it's not against the law, and you can get away with it, do it. And even if it's against the law, if you can get away with it, do it. If it feels good. Etc. So this is Padma Purana. Then concluding, in order to obtain the fruits of hearing the Bhagavatam, four things, one should have faith in the words of the spiritual master. Vishvaso guru vakyeshu. Vishvasa. Guru vakyeshu. Faith in the words of the spiritual master. So faith in the spiritual master allows for faith in the words of the spiritual master. Now, if the spiritual master is speaking the message of the Bhagavatam, you have faith in the Bhagavatam, you can have faith in the words of the spiritual master. It's both, the source and the person. Like the book Bhagavatam and the person Bhagavatam. You know from Nashta Prayeshu Abhadreshu Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. It's both the book and the person Bhagavata Seva. Nashta Prayeshu, Abhadreshu, the unwanted things can be eradicated as a result of Nityam Bhagavata Seva, by serving the book and the person. That requires faith in the book and the person, the words of, and the person speaking the words. The words of the Bhagavatam and the person speaking the words of the Bhagavatam. Both. We'll come back. And an attitude of humility about his own worth. Svasmin dinatve bhavana, dina, humility, having a humble estimation of one's own worth. That's two. Faith, humility. He should be victorious over the flaws of the mind. Whoa. Mana, dosha, jayas, jaiva. Mana, dosha, jaya. Dosha means fault, mana means mind, and jaya means victory. We could spend a lot of time on these. And then the fourth one. Have unswerved concentration on the topics he is hearing. Unswerving concentration on the topics he is hearing. Katayam nishchala matihi. Matihi is what the mind does. Nishchala, unflickering. Chala and achala are nishchala. Katayam nishchala mati. Concentration. This message very much connects with the message from yesterday evening, by the way. Those 21 characteristics of a human being. It connects. These in one sense, these are human traits, but these are human traits that now are specifically directed towards the spiritual master, and the Bhagavatam's message, the spiritual master is speaking. And it's then how you apply that message in your life. You know, in other words, your life becomes guided by that message. If you have faith in the message of the Bhagavatam, you'll hear it more attentively. And as you hear it more attentively, the message goes in. And the message goes in, it guides the activities of your life, because what's inside comes out. And that's what it's meant for. It's not meant for information. There's certainly tons of information. Tons and tons. In part of my travel, there's a nice young man, Indian man, that's a professor of physics, who's just becoming a devotee. So he's done his PhD in physics. You know, you take PhD in physics and you learn Big Bang cosmology and everything else. You learn the mechanistic view of the world. And then he becoming a devotee, he's got this non-mechanistic view of the world. And it's a very different paradigm, and how do you fit the two together? Well, in some cases they don't fit. But certainly the godlessness but the empiric observation part, it does fit. It's just the language is different, without going into too much detail. So it's for such a person who's had really, 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 really strong training in mechanistic science to come in contact with the Bhagavatam. There's a lot of information processing that go between this and that. But the purpose is not just to get, you know, how does this match with that? How does this picture, this paradigm match with that paradigm? I mean, one of the things that I told him, because he was asking something about Rahu and, you know, what is it? And so on. I said, to keep it really simple, there's, within the Vedas, there's Ayurveda. And Ayurveda speaks about health. And the health condition is a balance of three doshas. And when you have an imbalance this way, you get that disease, you get another imbalance that way, you get another disease, and it affects this organ, and it accelerates and becomes that and that and that. And that's an analysis of health and how to make health proper. Allopathy doesn't touch any of that. The language is altogether different. The problem is something else, and you pull something and put another machine part in and you're fixed. Without having anything to do with doshas and, you know, the imbalance of the body. So it's just a different way of addressing. So the language may look similar, but it's not necessarily even the same language. The words may mean something different altogether because of the context. So you have to learn what the Vedic paradigm is about cosmology, for example, or the fifth canto. And so when you, it's not necessarily going to match the paradigm that's from physics. But it doesn't mean this can't explain cosmology or that can't explain cosmology. It's just a different way, different picture. And some cases you can see how they fit. Some cases you can't. And I gave him references of people that are far more knowledgeable than I am in both cosmology and the planetarium picture of the universe. So back to the point I was making is the purpose of the Bhagavatam is transformation, it's not information. There's lots of information, tons of information, but the purpose behind the information is to connect you to the personality of Godhead, to see how everything is connected to Him. And seeing that connection, feeling that connection, living with that connection carries you to the personality of Godhead. That faith in the message helps one get there. And so these 4 points, faith in the bearer of the message, the person Bhagavat, faith in the person Bhagavat, who is transparently representing the message Bhagavat, helps one, enables one to receive its message properly. I'll tell the rest of the story. So when the Vishnu Dutas, or the agents of Hari, give this explanation to the narrator, where his stepbrother went back to Godhead, the agents of Lord Vishnu or Lord Hari say, Gokarna, here's some good news. You're going to speak the Bhagavatam again, and the persons who are hearing you speak the Bhagavatam again, they'll also hear the Bhagavatam again, and you're all going to get the same result. Just have to listen more attentively. Please. So, off they go. The Vishnu Dutas take the ghost now with a spiritual body to the Vaikuntha realm. He says, Govinda himself is going to come and take you back to Goloka. So the agents of Lord Vishnu are chanting the holy name on their Vimana on the way back to the spiritual world. 1 month later, on an auspicious time, Gokarna recites the Srimad Bhagavatam once again, same audience, and they're much more attentive this time. Much more attentive this time. And much to their amazement, at the completion of the Bhagavatam, here comes a whole bunch of Vimanas, decorated by personalities of the same description of what they saw before. And Govinda himself comes and embraces Gokarna, and Gokarna becomes transformed in bodily appearance to a resident of the spiritual world. And then, presto, the others also become transformed in bodily appearance, and they're all invited to go back to Godhead. And the distinction was because they heard properly. Their faith ramped up a whole bunch. Understanding the fruit of that hearing with attention. So we understand at least theoretically, the fruit of attentive chanting and the fruit of attentive hearing is good. It's something that we want. And still we're Durdaivam Idrish Mahajani Nanuraga. We don't have any raga. We don't have any attachment, attraction for the chanting of the holy name, or sufficient for hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam. So what do you do? Well, what we heard yesterday from Narada to Maharaj Yudhisthira is association with sadhus again and again. Hear the message again and again. It's in Bhakti Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami. Again and again, repetition is necessary because of the anarthas that are within our heart. It's necessary. The potency isn't diminished because there's anarthas in our heart. The effectiveness of our receiving that potency is diminished because there's anarthas in our heart. So we go on with the process of hearing with faith. And faith in the sound vibration and faith in the vibrator of the sound vibration. Otherwise it's not going to be effective. It means we won't be sufficiently attentive. Same back to now, the same as this message in chapter 3 of Canto 2 with the chanting of the holy name. It's being promoted as the Yuga Dharma and still we don't have traction. Our heart is steel framed. We make offenses. So that's our condition. You know, we don't need to cry, I have an anartha in my heart and so I'm not sufficiently attentive or I don't have sufficient faith. We take the position from where we are, acknowledge it, accept it, and make a plan to go the next step. One of our retreats in Gitanagari was just on this theme, acceptance and progress. Acceptance and progress. Bhaktivinoda Thakur teaches, if you don't make steps to progress, you won't progress. And if you don't make steps to progress, you'll regress. There's in spiritual life, you're either progressing or regressing. You're not treading water. We need to make steps to progress. And the matter, there's four matters. Matters of faith. Go back again. Faith in the words of the spiritual master, attitude of humility about his own worth, victorious over the flaws of the mind, and have unswerving concentration on the topics he is hearing. I'll tell one Prabhupada story in end. Something that I heard from Satsarup Maharaj, I later heard that the same story happened in Los Angeles, but the story that Satsarup Maharaj heard or told was from New York in relation to Brahmananda in the Los Angeles version. Is the same question to Prabhupada in Los Angeles from Karandar. Both Brahmananda and Karandar were super managers during their time, and the circumstance in New York was there were four devotees. Satsarup Maharaj happened to be there, one of the four, with Prabhupada, and Brahmananda was saying to Prabhupada, Prabhupada, how to remain humble, because I have all this service and people appreciating my service and heaps of praise and appreciation and so much responsibility and, you know, so much honor. How do we remain humble? Prabhupada stopped, put his cane on the sidewalk and said, like the big picture, in the vastness of the spiritual sky, there's unlimited spiritual planets, Vaikuntha planets. Largest amongst them is Goloka Vrindavan, where Radha and Krishna reside eternally. In that vastness of the unlimited spiritual sky, in some corner, there's a cloud of the material energy called Mahatattva. And within that Mahatattva, Mahavishnu, an expansion of the personality of Godhead, lies within the causal ocean. And from the body of Mahavishnu, unlimited numbers of universes come streaming from his body. And of all those unlimited universes streaming from his body, there's one universe where in one of the unlimited numbers of planets in that universe is this earth planet. And on this Earth planet, there are 7 continents, and one of those continents is North America. And part of North America is the United States. And out of the 50 United States, one state is New York State. And in New York State, there's one city called New York City. In New York City, there's so many millions of people in so many streets. And in this New York City, there's one island called Manhattan. And in Manhattan, there's so many people that live in Manhattan. And there's this little street called Mott Street, and Brahmananda standing here asking, how can I feel humble? And the response was, yes, Prabhupada. And a similar Prabhupada response to Karandar, who was in a similar position. If we take that's just the material energy, the big picture of everything, it's insignificant. We're insignificant. We're literally insignificant. And that's an essential... The reality of humility isn't just thinking low about yourself. It's really it's in relation to Krishna. We're so tiny. There's many other nice examples of this, but for sake of time, I won't go there. It's really easy to understand we're so insignificant. Besides, you get crushed by the wheel of time and circumstance. Just the reality picture is we're very tiny. Overestimating, exactly, narcissism is overestimating one's worth. It's the sign of our times. And because I think I'm so worthy, I don't even really try, because I'm a gifted, I'm told since I'm little, you're the best, you're the greatest, you're wonderful, you're the center, you're everything. And it's part of narcissism. It's part of the way the culture impacts, especially millennials, but everybody. Donald Trump is not an exception. The medicine is the Srimad Bhagavatam and the holy name. These two go perfectly together. So faith, proper positioning of our own worth, Durmati, the wicked ways of the mind, victorious over the flaws of the mind, and unswerving concentration on the topics. Then we can, this best of all the Puranas, the best of all the Vedas is this Bhagavad Purana. We hand it to us, please take one. We're so fortunate. So to get the fullness of that benefit, we have to hear in a proper manner. Discussion? It's a nice subject, isn't it? You can thank Kusha. And she heard it from someone else, but took the time to research it. Yeah.
The order perhaps doesn't matter.
No.
Okay.
They're all important. I mean, one could give an argument, it starts with humility. When you give an argument, it starts with proper association, and that help can help make one humble. Yes?
So, this question is based on the incident that you described about Parikshit Maharaj.
Mm.
So, in real life, in the hindsight, it's pretty easy to understand that all our miseries are because we are away from Krishna in this material world.
Mm.
And the solution is chanting and all these things. But then we are overwhelmed by the circumstances. We tend to blame either the circumstances or the people around us. So how to not do that?
Mm-hmm. In one sense, that the instruction to not do that should be sufficient, or can be sufficient. Have you attended the Festival of Inspiration? You know what I'm talking about, that thing that's in New Vrindavan? Yeah. There was a period of time I was one of the speakers, and then I started going to China. I told them, I'm not elastic enough to do everything. I have to cut something out, so I stopped going there. But every year that I went there, there was the keynote speaker was Peter Burwash. Is he still?
Yep.
Yes. So Peter Burwash, obviously he's not an initiated devotee, but he was was and is a very ardent follower of Prabhupada. And every year that I attended, he told the same story year after year after year, which is directly responsive to your question. He described that when he started Krishna consciousness, Prabhupada was visiting in Hawaii, and he was a tennis coach. He was teaching tennis teachers. He had like a whole company. And because he was working, he had some money, and devotees generally didn't have money, so he made a donation to the temple of something. Forget the number, 50,000? 5,000? Something, some number. And then some short while later, the temple president left and took his money with him. So next time Prabhupada came, he had an occasion to meet with Prabhupada, and in the course of the meeting with Prabhupada, he told him what happened. And he didn't know how Prabhupada was going to respond, but Prabhupada responded in a way that he didn't expect at all. He said, don't blame the instrument of your karma. Now, it doesn't mean it's okay, but it's how you view when something comes your way. Now that takes, yes, because your premise was, I know the philosophy, but when it happens, the mind doesn't stay with the philosophy. The mind goes to the instrument of your karma. You don't think about it's my karma. You think about why did that person do that thing, say that thing, cause this, grief to me or to those dear to me. It's not unique to Krishna consciousness. It's spiritual foundation understanding. And it takes spiritual foundation to go beyond the reacting that way. So just on the instruction to do so, and one of the ways that Peter has helped it go in his heart and stay in his heart is by saying it and acting accordingly. Don't blame the instrument of your karma. It doesn't mean you have to like the behavior. But you don't have to get entangled in the network of the karmic bondage by feeling the way that you're feeling, and you become implicated in the same thing again of the material karmic network by identifying with it. Something came my way. It's the same point. It's just taking it out of the context of Krishna consciousness, but it's the same point for any tradition. In the Christian tradition, a great saint is Saint Francis of Assisi. And Saint Francis of Assisi lived in Italy, because Assisi is in Italy. And he had an assistant named Leo. And there's many such stories, but one of them is Saint Francis, or Francis, was describing to Leo what pure joy is not, and basically materialism, and varieties of materialism. It's not what pure joy is. And so, I guess he was giving it in the negative. Leo asked, what is pure joy? Those are what it isn't. What is it? And St. Francis said, because they were walking in on a path going to a monastery, he said, supposing we reach the monastery, what is pure joy? We reach the monastery, and there's someone that's receiving us at the gate, and he asks, who are you? And we say, we're one of you, we're your brothers, we're your brethren, and we come here to take shelter in the monastery. And the person at the gate says, you're not one of us, you're a liar, you're a thief, get out of here. And so, but it's raining and it's stormy and we're drenched and wind and it's cold. Said, I'm locking the door. Get out. And closes the door. So all night long we're outside. And the morning comes and we knock on the door and it's the same fellow that comes to the door and he said, I told you to get out of here. You're thieves, you're rogues, you're bad people. And then I forget exactly how it concludes, but you know, this is pure joy. Because the Lord wants us to become humble and understand our insignificant position or something to that effect. And that's what he wants of us, and that kindness that he's sending to us is pure joy. Receiving the kindness he's sending to us, so that we're qualified to receive his mercy, or something to that effect. Now, that's nice. And it's one thing to know the philosophy and to say a nice story. It's another thing when somebody treats you that way. And that's St. Francis, not us. So sometimes it happens, the harsh treatment, so forth. It takes a spiritual foundation. There's many other nice examples of this. It takes a spiritual foundation. So there's nothing, otherwise we go to the material side. You know, the like and dislike, attraction and repulsion, happiness and distress, honor, dishonor, the duality of this world. We get sucked into that swirl of the material energy unless there's a spiritual core that we're grounded in. It's the reality that we work with, and then we function in the world of duality based on that place of consciousness. There's no substitute. You can practice, you can become tolerant. A strength for tolerance is the mood of service. A humble mood of service. Like the example of the tree. The tree tolerates and the tree serves. And service isn't conditioned by whether it's hot or cold. Anything? Yes?
You mentioned about the narcissism among young people. I actually studied that in college. I was inspired by this book. It's called Generation Me. It's a psychologist that studied narcissism.
Yeah, yeah.
So I studied it in correlation with things like helping behavior and empathy. And it was interesting, just recently in one of the purports in the 10th canto, this has been described as the me generation. Srila Prabhupada's
really?
Yeah. It's there, I don't remember.
Where?
It's in the chapters around the time where Krishna is, there's the brahmanas, and they don't give food to Krishna's cowherd boyfriends,
yeah,
but the wives do.
Yes.
It's around that region, so either before or after that. If I find it, I'll let you know.
It's easy to search for it.
And
and that's part of what Prabhupada translated, I believe. It's not, so in other words, it's not the disciples of Prabhupada, it's Prabhupada's purport.
Okay.
the me generation.
I had a question about that.
Okay.
Is that, because the way you describe narcissism, it was interesting that it's based on all this pretense and external.
Yes.
And it's interesting that though the youngest generation is so focused on that in many ways, yet somehow when they receive one of these books that we'll give them, then the consciousness actually puts faith in the development of character, which is the opposite of that.
Well, the potential is there. Sometimes that doesn't happen. The potency is there. It depends on the receptivity. Depends on how wet or dry the wood is, whether it would ignite. Okay. Looks like it's prasadam time. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
His Holiness Ramakrishna Maharaj ki jai.